Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We've said it before on this program, but I think it bears re-mentioning that we really spend far more than any other country, developed country at least, on healthcare. And also, by many measures, we receive less in return in quality care. In addition, many Americans have no health care coverage at all. The Affordable Care Act attempts to provide access to health care to many more Americans, but really seems to do little to address cost and quality of health care. In this program, we're going to be discussing efforts to address these other two problems, cost and quality, with Dr. Richard Antonelli of Children's Hospital Boston and Harvard Medical School. Dr. Antonelli has written, researched, and consulted extensively on the provision of integrated care into pediatrics and how that can help increase quality and make value for healthcare better. Dr. Antonelli, welcome to Line One.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me this afternoon.
As we discuss this topic, again, what integrated health care is and what we can do in this country to improve quality and value, we were more than happy to welcome your listeners with questions and comments. You can reach us directly during the next hour at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we have a toll-free number as well, 1-888-353-5752. Well, let's make sure I'm getting the facts right. Would you agree with the introduction that we have some healthcare problems that sometimes we fail to understand or see or realize, at least compared to the rest of the world?
Yes, I think let's start from a point which will kind of set the frame for this conversation broadly. We, in fact, are the country that spends the most dollars or most capital, if you will, on the delivery of medical services. And as you correctly pointed out, we rank somewhere between 27th and 30th amongst other countries in terms of the quality of the outcomes, including longevity, functional status as our population ages, prematurity for delivery. So by many of the measures of delivery system quality, we rank relatively low.
And one of the efforts you've been involved in for quite a number of years now is this idea of integrated care. Can you define what we're talking about there? And then, in a sense, how is that addressing these issues of cost and quality?
Yeah. So let me draw a connection back to the first question and sort of looking at the American healthcare delivery system compared to our international counterparts. In those countries that have the best outcomes, longer lifespan, higher functional status, lower rates of things like obesity, heart disease, premature status, many of those models of care delivery have a very strong component of community-based primary care. There are subspecialty services that are available, but the number of primary care providers per patient population tend to be higher in those countries with the best outcomes. Part of that is because many of the resources through primary care are focused on educating people before they become patients. So this is educating children, educating families, educating adults about how to maintain health and well-being, and not just waiting until they develop a disease and then treating them. So thinking about the lens of the primary care connected to subspecialty care. Let me define for the listeners. Primary care providers are generally trained to take care of a broad range of problems. These would be pediatricians, internal or general medicine physicians, family physicians, medicine pediatrics physicians. Also included in this group would be folks trained in primary care like nurse practitioners and physician assistants. So those primary care providers have a broad knowledge, but their depth in any particular complicated conditions is somewhat limited. So for those folks, we have subspecialists. So people that specialize in heart diseases, cardiology, neurological diseases, psychiatry for mental and behavioral health issues. So I just want to make sure the listeners understand that distinction. Sure. So in this country, we've got we're relatively richly blessed with lots of subspecialty care. Especially in the adult side, there's a significant lack of primary care capacity. What integrated care attempts to do is to redefine how subspecialty providers and primary care providers can interact around the care for a population. Allow me to be specific here, and I'll use an example here for a behavioral health or a mental health problem. So let's talk about a teenager with depression. Primary care providers have some training, some expertise in diagnosing and treating depression. But oftentimes we need some assistance with the diagnosis and the management. In the traditional model, one would identify that adolescent and then refer them on to the behavioral health, to the psychiatrist. Families know very well that finding psychiatric services, mental health services, behavioral health services is very, very challenging. With our integrated approach, we are doing joint training between the subspecialty providers, in this case psychiatry, and primary care providers. That training includes a component of for the families as well, so that they can perceive that that primary care provider actually has a projection of some of the knowledge of the psychiatrist into that interaction. So there's a transparency for families, there's a new way of diagnosing and managing these patients, and you're able to spread those limited behavioral health resources across the community. And it's all predicated on a high-performing primary care setting. Let me stop there and give you a chance to reflect on that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes lots of sense, and it's something that at times I have two comments. One, I think the public thinks that already happens to some degree, and as a member of physicians for 30 years, I don't think it happens in the past nearly as well as it's beginning to happen as we move into more integrated care, and particularly after the availability of intercommunicability with electronic medical records, for example. And I forgot my other thought. So it's not quite as I think it's people thought it was being done well. I don't think it has been done very well. And certainly we're moving into doing that, improving increasingly well. And does that save money? Is it increase quality and save money to do this? We know that for sure.
Yes. Well, there's some actually, before I jump to the outcomes,
okay.
Let me first address that notion that you just said, is that patients and families would just expect this would happen, and that you as a practitioner have recognized that, in fact, there's some movement in this direction. But let me cite a couple of studies that, for me, really anchor me in this space to make things better. So a colleague of mine, and Christopher Stilla, who is now at the University of Colorado, did some studies over a decade ago and basically looked at the percentage of time that a patient was identified by a primary care provider and then was referred to a subspecialist, and found that only about a third of the time, only about 33% of the time, did that subspecialist feel they had sufficient information at that consultation to provide optimal care. Mm-hmm. Let's think about that. Mm-hmm. If you went to the auto mechanic and a third of the time the mechanic could give you optimal advice about whether you needed to have your brakes changed, you would be rather disconcerted. But in fact, this evidence, handoffs of care, if you will, are the right questions getting formulated and are they getting transmitted the right place? In fact, we're far from perfect. I also just recently completed a study with a family group called the Parent Professional Advocacy League. They're based here in Massachusetts, and they are a group that focuses its advocacy efforts on supporting children and families with behavioral or mental health needs. We did a survey of families who were part of a medical home project, as a matter of fact. 86% of the time, families said they were solely responsible for finding the necessary subspecialty, or in this case, mental health services for their children. 86% of the time. Imagine for the listeners, if you were having wheezing or chest pain, if 86% of the time you were solely responsible for finding that heart specialist or that lung specialist. But for behavioral health, it's actually pretty common. So that, Tad, sort of sets the framework, if you will. We actually have measures in the system that show that there are big gaps. Now, let's talk a little bit about your perception as a physician as to why it looks like things are moving in that direction. Well, as I always say, if you can't describe something, you can't measure it. And if you can't measure something, you can't improve it. So I'm very excited to share that families across the country, and this is not unique to pediatrics, this applies to adult medicine as well, are starting to have expectations that say, you know, what is it that I can expect when I go to my primary care provider for a checkup or for a complaint? And if I need to be referred, how do I know that information gets to the next place? One of the tools that you've articulated, it described, is electronic medical records. The ability to have information, which families could then give consent for other providers to look at, is key. But we also need to have measures of the family's experience. Do they perceive that one provider is communicating to another provider specifically to help them integrate or coordinate care across the community, from a primary care setting, maybe to a subspecialty setting, or to a hospital setting if somebody needs to get it admitted? So it's we now have the technology, and we're developing some of these measures. And I'm particularly excited to share with your listeners, we're developing this discipline of care coordination. Just like you would never want to go to a doctor and not have an idea that they were appropriately trained, for these children, youth, adults that need care across providers, we want to be able to develop a set of skills that the families themselves can be their own care coordinators, or for those families that need some assistance, that we can grow a workforce of care coordinators. Now, these are not physicians, so they're not expensive personnel at all. And in some areas of the country, I'm actually soliciting folks from the very communities that they will then serve. Some states call these community health workers. And we're finding, Tad, that these community health workers or care coordinators, in fact, are able to find patients who need services and link them to services.
Okay. Let me remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. My guest today is Dr. Richard Antonelli of Children's Hospital Boston and Harvard Medical School, and we're discussing some efforts that are growing nationally, really gaining some traction, I'm learning specifically, about how to improve health care by integrating systems a little bit more carefully. Our local number, if you have questions or comments, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Listeners who are attuned to this may also hear words like a patient or family-centered medical care or medical homes. How does that interact? How does that relate to the integrated healthcare movement?
Yeah, so that's a very important question, and let's sort of tackle it head on. I was involved with the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is credited with essentially coining the term medical home. And over the last 20 to 25 years, I and many other folks across the country and increasingly across the world have focused on improving primary care. In 2007, I was part of an initiative that included family medicine and internal medicine and osteopathic medicine, and we came out with a joint principles of the so-called patient-centered medical home. For the listeners, the way you should be thinking about a patient-centered or family-centered medical home is that it is a high-performing primary care model. What do we mean by high-performing? We actually have some standards that we've been able to articulate. One is the primary care setting is accessible to you, the patient, and family when you need it, around the clock and throughout the year. Two, they understand the culture from which you come. So we call that culturally effective. Three, there's continuity in the relationship. Your record is with this particular provider or this particular system, and over time, information accrues to that record so that you are able to sit with a provider in that primary care setting who knows your history and is learning about your present and can help you think about your approach to the future. There's a sense of comprehensiveness. This is particularly important for some of the topics we're going to be talking about tonight. Comprehensive care, what does that mean to the listeners? Well, if somebody comes in to me, a 35-year-old who's wheezing, and I listen and say, well, here's your prescription for this inhaler, but I don't make them feel comfortable to say, but I'm living in an environment where there is lots of secondhand smoke. Or, you know, in addition to the wheezing, I also don't have access to food. Or there are issues with substance dependence. So in other words, that ability for the patient and family to feel that I want to put all of my problems on the agenda when we have these conversations. So continuous, compassionate, there's a real sense of caring. The relationship, you know, humans thrive on relationships. One of the blessings, if you will, of primary care is that the person that you have a relationship with knows you, knows your family over time. The care is also coordinated, just what we talked about a few moments ago. If a patient is identified who needs to receive care outside of that primary care setting in a hospital or subspecialty setting, the information is captured and it's sent on to the next provider. So the patient feels that their care, in fact, and information flow is continuous and complete. So essentially, that is one way to think about that medical home. Perhaps in a more concrete fashion, I'll point out something else that is a very powerful tool for these primary care settings, and that's it's called a registry. if you will. It's a way of knowing who the patients are in a community with a particular condition. And in a high-performing primary care setting can say, these are the patients we have with asthma. These are the ones that have been through our asthma teaching program. These are the ones that we call every year for their influenza vaccines. These are the ones that are cigarette smokers, and these are the ones that we can make referrals for smoking cessation. So the primary care medical home also has the ability to think about the population of patients it serves, so not just that individual patients, but a community level. And those essentially are the key elements of a high-performing primary care model, otherwise known as the patient and family-centered medical home.
So in a sense, these primary patient or family-centered medical homes are really working under a bunch of guiding principles that allows them to be accredited and substantiate that they're going to be able to provide these services. And only part of that is this integrated healthcare. I mean, they have to be good at that, but they're going beyond that to address more total needs of their patients.
That's exactly right, and now you're creating an opportunity for us to segue and say, okay, what are the things that would hold back that high performing primary care model? Well, this is where we're going to start getting into some of the issues around paying for healthcare. So, for the listeners, one model of paying for healthcare is called fee for service. So each time a provider, doctor, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, each time they see a patient, they get paid for that. So if it takes me 6 visits to take care of a 6-year-old who's wheezing, I would get paid. Now, in that environment, nobody is saying, gosh, you know, if you had only done the right thing the first time, you wouldn't have needed to do those 5 other visits. So this is where you start to call in out the opportunity to measure quality and to promote the teaching interventions. And so fee-for-service is a very traditional model. It's what most physicians in the country, in fact, to this day, still are laboring under. But they're rewarded for doing visits. Visits aren't always necessarily the most high-value service. We've done some national studies and found that sometimes families just need some guidance that could be given by telephone. Or increasingly, and I know this is something that's exciting about Alaska's landscape, is the ability to do telemedicine. And those virtual connections to ask advice and to offer guidance are very high value propositions. And moving our policy world forward to enable new ways of paying for care will, in fact, I think, enable us to achieve some of those high performing levels for that medical home model.
All right. I want to come back to this idea of payment. I think it's an important one, and perhaps one of the problems. Although I find from my recent understanding is a lot of payers are jumping onto this bandwagon of payment centered family medical home. But I do have a caller, and I want to take her question. Nicole, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. My question is back to an earlier subject you mentioned. Physicians. My initial degree was pre-med. I ended up going a different way, but of all my friends that went on to become doctors, every one of them is a specialist. And I, you know, you just don't see the numbers of physicians, internists, hospitalists, pediatricians, some of these more basic medical providers, but you see, you know, a lot of these kids going into cardiothoracic surgery or neuroradiology or some of these, you know, if they just do a little bit of a fellowship, they can make a lot more money. And how do you entice today's medical students into going into the more basic healthcare professions?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. In fact, when you look at the debt load to go through undergraduate college and then medical school, hundreds of thousands of dollars accrue. And at the end of that tunnel, you're exactly right. Coming out into primary care and maybe, owing between $250,000 and $500,000 per physician. And primary care providers, in fact, make a fraction of what procedure-based subspecialists make. So you've called out a very important issue for the system. Now, I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that we don't need those procedure specialists. We absolutely do, and oftentimes they are literally life-saving. But we know from international data, and we know from data in the U.S. as well, that high value also accrues by having those community-based resources. And so I would even broaden the challenge that the listener just put forward and talk about, attracting physician assistants and nurse practitioners into that workforce as well.
Is it my understanding that there are apparently changes afoot and that more and more medical students are choosing primary care electives compared to, let's say, 10 years ago? Is that true?
Choosing electives or choosing
specialties, pathways into primary care, pediatrics, family practice, internal medicine?
Yeah. So, in fact, the most recent data it has suggested that there is a bit of an uptick in the number of folks choosing family medicine nationally. But I think the caller's observation still is pretty prominent there. And I think that a lot of the medical schools themselves, I do a lot of work with nursing and with social work in the space that I'm in. We'll get to that later on in the call, I'm sure. But to the degree that we can sort of look across all of these health provision workforce resources and say, how can we work collectively? The answer I would like to submit to your listeners is that it's not all, it shouldn't just be on the backs of physicians, if you will. I think physicians need to understand, what can I do to optimally provide outcomes? Can we embrace working across these teams that include the patients and the families, include our nurses, colleagues, both RNs, LPNs, as well as nurse practitioners, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the answer going forward is going to be very much based on team-based performance, but I still think we need to figure out ways of incentivizing medical schools to generate more primary care providers, to be sure.
All right. Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. We're going to take our usual mid-break here. Our local number again is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Antonelli on the advantages of integrated care in the patient-centered medical home. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And today we're discussing integrated health care. We're discussing the patient-centered medical home, some new changes that are gaining traction across the country to address issues in cost and quality of health care, as we also struggle to get more and more of our citizens with some kind of health care coverage. My guest is Dr. Richard Antonelli of Harvard Medical School and Children's Hospital Boston, who's very widely read and studied and actually has written and has consulted on these issues, and he's sharing his knowledge with us today. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org, or you can call us locally at 550-8433. One more time, our toll-free number also, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Antonelli, let's come back to this cost issue a little bit. And before we go there, let me ask a question that you've begun to address in some of your comments, and that is, how are the primary care providers, the pediatricians, the family practice, internal medicine, and others having to change their practices to meet these ideals of the patient-centered medical home and integrated health care?
Yeah, I see you have asked a profoundly important question, and I'm going to segment my answer a little bit. So some of the first work in the area of pediatrics for the medical home, in fact, was specifically designed around providing high-quality, coordinated care for children with chronic conditions. We know from national data that up to 40% of American children have some sort of chronic condition or are at risk of having a chronic condition, like a developmental problem, for example, asthma, diabetes, seizure disorders, et cetera. So a significant portion of the population. So much of the early work of the American Academy of Pediatrics was around providing care for kids with chronic conditions. In that fee-for-service world, to refresh the listeners' memory, this is, you see a patient, you get paid. Well, you think about what life would be like if a provider could see 10 patients per hour, nobody having anything more complicated than, say, a sore throat, or one patient an hour, a patient with learning problems, say with a developmental problem like autism, asthma, you could see immediately how that payment model of fee-for-service really created quite a gap for the very patients that the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, was trying to provide that medical home for. So part of the change early, and say in the last 15 years or so in pediatrics, was to begin to incentivize those providers to give them the tools they needed to be able to start creating care coordination systems and having some measurements of quality for kids with chronic conditions. I am excited to say that as we start to move slowly across the country, various states are adopting these newer models of payment. We'll talk a little bit about what they mean, but essentially we're starting to see a movement away from that fee-for-service model toward a model of care where you're actually getting paid to take care of a population. Before I go there, Tad, though, let me make sure that I can balance this by talking a bit about the adult medical home model. A lot of the emphasis on the adult side has been for patients with Medicare, and particularly Medicare patients that have certain chronic conditions that are common, cardiovascular disease, musculoskeletal disease, arthritis, if you will, cerebrovascular disease, so stroke problems, cancer. These are very common chronic conditions that affect our senior citizens in the U.S. primary care medical homes that take care of these patients are able to look at who are my patients with stroke and how am I doing taking care of them. So thinking a little bit more broadly and out across the community, rather than reacting to whoever happens to be sitting in front of you at that particular time. So I hope that'll give a sense to the listeners now about how these medical homes are different. Rather than my seeing 60 kids coming through my door today, maybe I'll have a very productive day and only see 15 or 20, but then I've managed a lot of them through my virtual connections, through my computer linkages, for example, or telephonically. Mm-hmm. So this is starting to come back to your question now. So what are these primary care settings look like now that are different? Well, as you pointed out correctly several minutes ago, having access to electronic tools, an electronic medical record, and the ability of one electronic medical record to seamlessly relate or communicate with another one, that's called interoperability. And on a national scene, we're really not there yet. The development of a workforce that understands how to manage these transitions of care from an inpatient setting, a hospital setting, if you will, back into a community, maybe a residential placement, primary care provider, subspecialty care. So having access to these folks that can coordinate care. That's another part of how primary care is evolving. And then a greater degree of transparency on measurement. So measuring outcomes that matter. Early on in when Medical Home was first starting to roll out, primary care providers were said, well, of course you're just going to, you know, review, do all of this data collection, and that'll be superimposed on the 16-hour workdays that you're currently doing. And, oh, by the way, there's no additional money. And you can imagine how challenging that was. So one of the things that electronic medical records are starting to enable is the ability to capture outcome data so that primary care providers can focus on doing what they need to do, which is supporting patients and families at their time of need. So those are just some of the changes that we're starting to see right now, Ted.
Before we move on to evidence for cost effectiveness and how payers and the government and the patients and maybe the providers themselves are looking at these changes, I want to talk about one more integration we've mentioned just briefly because I think it's extremely important, and that's the closer integration of mental health services with primary care providers, perhaps to the extent that they're in the same office, very closely related, and they're seeing you almost simultaneously or during the same office visit. Is that happening? Is it important? What are your comments on that?
Yes, I will share some data with you and with the listeners. Over the course of the last year, we have looked at the expenses for our patients in the Boston area who have insurance, and looked at them as a function of what their problems are. So we've looked at how much money do we spend on children with cancer? How much do we spend on children with seizure disorders? How much do we spend on children with heart disease? And we went through that. And in fact, the highest cost across the community population is children that have behavioral and mental health needs. This kind of data is also representative of the adult population as well. Somewhere between 100% and 400% is the increase in cost for patients that have a mental health condition in addition to an underlying quote-unquote medical condition. So, for example, adults with diabetes and depression are much more expensive to take care of, and they have poor outcomes. So I'm spending a lot of time here in Boston and in my work with multiple states and at the national level, saying, here's an area that there's lots of excessive and really inefficient spending occurring. And we already have demonstrations in adults in particular and some pediatric outcomes of an integrated behavioral health model, in fact, improving the quality of outcomes and reducing the cost of care. This is a key opportunity that any delivery system, any state could take on tomorrow. But it transcends, it goes beyond just handing out booklets and papers and having people give talks about this. This really is a new way of providing care. You've alluded to having a licensed independent clinical social worker, an LICSW, in a primary care practice. And in fact, we call that a co-located model. A co-located model in and of itself might be very convenient. So, Tad, if a patient comes in to see you and you have a concern about a behavioral health need, let's say it's that teenager who you're suspecting has depression, if you simply send them down the hall to the social worker and basically say, good, I don't have to worry about this kid anymore because my social worker is going to take care of it, then that's not an integrated model. That co-location basically just made it more convenient for the family. In an integrated model, there would be a seamless connection between you, the primary care provider, the family understanding what role you would continue to play going forward, why the referral was made to that person on site, that clinical social worker, if you will, and there would be a care plan, a plan of care with treatment goals that you would work with the patient and family and with the social worker to be able to craft that. And that what a lot of programs are doing, and we're doing that here in Massachusetts now, is because there aren't enough child and adolescent psychiatrists to meet need, we then can have a virtual connection between our psychiatry team and the folks out in the community doing that co-located social worker primary care model. I hope that your listeners can appreciate just how different this model is from the traditional model.
It was, in researching for this, and even though we've done a program, or actually two programs on the Accountable Care Act and the health exchanges, I was reminded in my research that there are 10 essential health benefits to, required in these in the, by the Accountable Care Act, one of which is parity of mental behavioral health and substance abuse care in the health insurance exchange policies. Now, the devil is in the detail in some of those, but it seems to me there is this national recognition of the importance of bringing some parity into mental health and medical care coverage.
Yes, I think that's a very important point. And then I would emphasize, however, that parity in terms of providing resources, paying for it, if you will, is very it's essential to be successful. But we know enough about the behavioral health system as a standalone system compared to the medical system as a standalone system to know that it's not just an issue of money. We need to change the model. And I think that the parity will enable those dollars to flow into this new model. And fortunately, we've got evidence accumulating in the adult and early evidence in the pediatric space to suggest this new model is absolutely the way to go. Parity sets the stage for that.
All right. Well, let's move on
to the costs here. There's increased costs to practices, I know, with electronic medical records, which the government has helped us pay for. But we're spending more time with patients. We, in our office, actually have a patient navigator who helps us make sure patients are getting where they're supposed to go. The records are getting there. We're getting feedback. We're trying to find out why they missed appointments, how we can help them get to appointments. And that's, at least in the current fee-for-service model we use up here, we don't get reimbursed for that. So if this is to be successful, there has to be a change in payers as well as the government, it appears, to realize there must be some financial trade-off to make these changes. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So let's start with the term value, and let me define for the listeners what value means. The value equation is the quality of something per unit cost, and so, you know, think about an item that you might buy, a durable piece of equipment, a boat, higher quality, higher cost, et cetera. So let's begin with the value proposition here. What is the quality of what we're receiving now as a population? And we already know that the cost is extremely high. In order to be able to move forward with these new payment models, I actually believe that the payers, the insurers, if you will, both the public ones, Medicaid and Medicare, and commercial ones, they need to be convinced that if they're going to be allocating these dollars, that they know what the outcomes are going to wind up being. This is where families and patients, consumers, and health advocates, community health advocates, policy folks. This is where a year ago when I came to Alaska to meet with many stakeholder groups, I was encouraging them to say, what is it that you want to focus on? It would be really challenging for me to make a recommendation to any payer, public or private, and say, just start paying differently. I think that would lead to chaos. But if we could begin to start focusing on mental health, substance abuse, literacy, food security, obesity, asthma, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, you know, on a community-by-community basis, if you could get folks to say, what is our priority and what do we need to get there? Then you have the ability to take the resources, the dollars, if you will, and support that. So you mentioned a patient navigator. We're finding nationally that many expensive patients, patients that need to receive care across multiple delivery systems, in hospital, out of hospitals, specialized nursing facilities, mental health providers, physical health providers, et cetera, oftentimes those patients basically either have very poor outcomes or they always use one common denominator, which is there's a problem, I don't know where to go, I wind up in the emergency room. So this notion of a navigator in conjunction with to be able to help fulfill a care plan that the primary care provider in conjunction with the family creates, that addresses the needs and priorities of the patient and the family, these folks are a new element of the delivery system, but because so much money is wasted in between handoffs, if you will, they are going to absolutely have an impact on unnecessary utilization, inappropriate utilization, and they're going to strengthen that community-based primary care medical home. Mm-hmm.
I want to give a concrete example I heard recently at a meeting, and that was using a psychologist in a neonatal intensive care unit. It's $10,000 per day on the average nationally is what the statistic I heard to keep a neonate in a neonatal intensive care unit. And by adding a psychologist, they decreased the average length of stay per
per neonate 3 days, so that's $30,000 per neonatal intensive care patient. It easily paid for itself in no time by just...
That's exactly right. We did a study about 8 years ago nationally, and we looked at care coordinators, and these folks, depending on the practice, we looked at one in particular on the Eastern Seaboard where they had a very large asthma population. Their care coordinator was a mother from their practice whose child had asthma. But she had become so well trained in how to manage asthma and how to navigate the system that, in fact, that one practice that had a parent trained as a care coordinator, annualized savings just for asthma, just for that one practice, was about $1 million. Wow. This person made $25 an hour.
So that, again, I want to throw out another term. It's when you get these care coordinators like I envision this person, you're getting in a little bit more into what I think of as a disease management. You're calling these patients. You're saying, what's the problem? Why are you not getting the medications? Are you understanding how to give the medications, how they work, and so forth? Is that also along the same lines of what you're talking about here?
Well, it's related, and in fact, I'm going to answer that question in the geriatric world, but there will be a line of sight to pediatrics. So a dear friend of mine named Eric Coleman, who is a geriatrician at the University of Colorado, developed a questionnaire of three simple questions. These questions, when offered to an elderly patient being discharged from a hospital, are highly correlated with that patient being readmitted in an unplanned fashion. So so-called unplanned readmissions, 20% or more of all Medicare beneficiaries in the United States get readmitted to hospitals, and it was never planned. So needless to say, there's an awful lot of money wasted there. Dr. Coleman's work asked these three questions, and then when families indicate, you know, I'm not really sure I understand my medications, I'm not really sure why I need to see my primary care provider, his intervention is not to do the work for those families, but in fact he offers a coach. And that was part of how you framed your question. A coach is somebody that teaches the patient, the family, about how to navigate the system. Well, how could you find out why you need to see your primary care provider? What can we give you so you understand the need for that additional testing, et cetera? So a very critical part of these integrated care models, in fact, is empowering the patients and the families, giving them education, giving them mentorship, and providing support. In the pediatric space, in particular around mental and behavioral health, families have told us on the national scene very clearly, when you are concerned about a mental health diagnosis with our child, in addition to engaging us in the care plan, we also would like a referral to a resource for somebody that's walked in our own shoes before. So I want to make sure we have time, Tad, on this conversation to really appreciate we don't just want to think about patients and families as the dependent ones here. Healthcare needs to be re-engineered and redesigned to empower patients and families and to be able to motivate them to have optimal health outcomes. Eventually, we all will need medical services, but the delivery for education and support so families and patients can be more empowered to manage themselves and navigate systems, we need to be aiming for that kind of a healthcare delivery system.
Wow, that's that's one area where I haven't gone yet, and the whole idea of motivation is a difficult one. We are certainly seeing ourselves, and I think I see the country moving towards where we're trying to really do more to make a difference in the patients' lives, but I haven't gotten there in my own mind or haven't heard that. I think that's an important observation, though.
Yeah, it's and it's really been profoundly influential in my thinking as I've gone more and more into the behavioral health space. Behavioral health. And in fact, let me define for the listeners: behavioral health encompasses mental health, substance abuse and dependence, and lifestyle choices, healthy eating habits, and the like. So all of those are encompassed in behavioral health. But the family voice there has been extremely strong and laser focused. We need help navigating. We need mentorship. And for myself as a physician, I have to tell you, Ted, I always celebrate when a family comes into me and says, "I need you to help me take care of me." You know, that's an empowered patient. Now, they still have needs, but they're basically saying, "Here's my agenda. I want you to help me." I embrace and actively encourage that kind of engagement on behalf of patients and families, especially for patients that have chronic conditions.
Right. All right. Boy, we've covered a lot. There's more to do. We've only got a couple of minutes here. Let's wrap this up by let me ask you in the last minute and a half or 2 minutes or so, Dr. Antonelli, to summarize what you see happening now, if I'm not overextending, in healthcare. How do you see this happening? Is it going to happen? And how important is it going to be? What do we want our listeners to remember from this program in particular?
Well, I think the challenges for American healthcare are exactly as you laid them out at the beginning of the hour, which is to say, we spend more money than any other country, and yet our outcomes are so poor. We would never tolerate that in any other sector of our society. So consequently, changes have to occur. We can't sustain this rate of spending for healthcare in the United States of America. So the question about should we or shouldn't we change, as far as I'm concerned, that question's been answered. The question that we need to grapple with is, okay, how will we change? I, for one, am very much focused on what are we trying to accomplish. So begin with the end in mind. So let's say a community in Alaska wants to focus on reducing obesity. Well, the interventions there are going to, you know, they should be applicable to what the local resources and needs are. There may be a different set of interventions for obesity, for example, than I would use here in inner city Boston. But that's okay as long as we are measuring those outcomes. The behavioral health space is one that I am particularly passionate about for the reason that I mentioned. Between 100 and 400% more expensive are these patients. If we do a poor job with behavioral and mental health, either screening or treatment, unfortunately, these folks often become homeless. They aren't productive member societies. And worst case scenario is they often fall into the criminal justice world where they're very expensive. So my advice is focus on what your outcomes are going to be, include families, and advance the system toward value.
Boy, thanks very much, Dr. Antonelli, for taking the time.
It's my pleasure. Good luck to you. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Thank you. On the next program, we're going to address heart disease and local advances in cardiac care with Dr. Stanley Watkins of the American Heart and Vascular Institute. So why not join us? Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.